www.ReachForYourGreatness.org.
Welcome back to Midpoint, friends, on this September 17th, 2025. I'm your host, Shelley Reback. Things are getting intense out here, aren't they? It has been a very eventful week. Normally, I try to keep my news Florida-focused because it is so difficult to get Florida news now that daily local newspaper reporting and reading is on the wane. But this week, it's impossible to ignore the backwash of what is happening nationally, because as a conservative Republican-controlled state, what happens here in Florida affects the entire USA, and what happens nationally in our politics gets supercharged in Florida. In a few minutes, we are going to be talking about Florida's first-in-the-nation proposal to ban all mandatory vaccines, particularly for public school children, with my guests, infectious disease specialist Dr. Tom Unash and president-elect of the Hillsborough County Medical Association, Dr. Neil Matamala. But before we get to vaccinations and to my guests, let's take a look at the national news we've been affected by this week. Top of the news, of course, is the murder of political influencer Charlie Kirk. No doubt Kirk was a very important Republican activist. He had enormous value to the Republican Party as someone who was very successful in recruiting young people, particularly on college campuses, to register and vote for Republican candidates and to join the whole conservative Republican political ecosystem through his organization, Turning Point USA, which incidentally had its national convention or student action summit right here in Tampa in July. You know, Kirk's murder was a tragedy, no matter what you think of his politics. A man is dead, kids have lost a father, another young man is facing the death penalty, and we are faced with the consequences of this assassination. I don't want to talk too much about Kirk. I do want to talk about his shooter, because this killing will have consequences far beyond the death of one man, and these consequences will be dangerous, potentially violent, and horribly disruptive at a minimum for those of us who don't share Kirk's politics. So why was he shot? The evidence is very murky so far. His shooter may have been radicalized by a competing Christian conservative group led by another Christian conservative influencer named Nick Fuentes, around whom a cult called the Groypers has developed. The words and phrases carved into bullet casings found with his weapon seem to indicate that Kirk's shooter was a so-called soldier in the Groyper Wars, a mostly online political competition between Kirk's TPUSA followers and those of Nick Fuentes' Groypers, each group competing for the allegiance of conservative, young, primarily white men, each accusing the other of not being conservative enough. Lately, the Groypers have engaged in disruptions at Turning Point events. I guess this shooting was the ultimate act of disruption. But there's also some evidence that the shooter, who was raised in a Republican, Mormon, MAGA conservative family, just thought Kirk was, according to him, spreading too much hate. From documents filed yesterday by the Republican prosecution team in Utah, we learned his mother has allegedly said that the shooter had become more pro-gay and trans rights oriented after dating his roommate, a male who was allegedly transitioning to female. So was this shooting an act born of some twisted romantic chivalry with no real political agenda? Is this a convenient story told to justify a crackdown on left and progressive movements? It's a legitimate question, since Republican public officials and pundits were blaming the left even before the shooter had been apprehended. They needed the shooter to be a leftist, not just another conservative from a different conservative sect. So today, all we really know about him is that he was into guns, gaming, and was probably bisexual. But he doesn't seem to have a clear political worldview. But never mind that. Even though there is no clear evidence that Charlie Kirk's death was politically motivated or caused by an actual leftist, his death has made him Trump's Horst Wessel, his propaganda martyr. He's become a massive propaganda symbol, one deserving, I guess, of a memorial statue at the new conservative New College in Sarasota, and the Trump administration is already using Charlie Kirk to demonize the left and threaten us in the same way that Hitler used Horst Wessel, a young Nazi killed by a communist in 1930 Berlin and turned into a martyr for Hitler's movement. So, no matter who shot Charlie Kirk, Kirk is also being martyred, and he's being used by the right as a cause to go to war on the left. Not metaphorical, ideological war. I'm talking about violent, physical war. This is why political violence is so dangerous. It is the match that lights the fuse that explodes violence beyond control. And this match has lit the fuse in a gun-worshipping, grievance-bound cult already predisposed to violence. Trump has already called out for vengeance and retribution. Already, even before the shooter was caught, several historically black colleges were forced to close due to credible threats of violence against them and their students. Steve Bannon has said, quote, "We are at war in this country." Elon Musk has said, quote, "Our choice is to fight or die." Alex Jones also said, quote, "We're in a war." Jack Prosobiec said, quote, "What comes next will be swift, it will be quick, and it will be retribution." And Jesse Waters on Fox has said, quote, "We're going to avenge Charlie's death. Everybody's accountable. And we're watching the politicians, the media, and all these rats out there," close quote. Stephen Miller has said, quote, "The fate of millions depends upon the defeat of this leftist wicked ideology." And I don't think Miller means on the debate stage. Other right-wing spokespeople have referred to the left as, quote, "demonic," and called for swift retribution in the form of an aggressive crackdown against their political enemies. And yesterday, J.D. Vance called for a mass doxing of anyone who expressed anything about Kirk that was less than reverential. He called on his supporters to snitch on workers who make offensive remarks about the Charlie Kirk, and his supporters have obliged. A national hotline set up for such snitches has received something like 63,000 calls in just days of people informing on their friends, relatives, neighbors, and coworkers who've expressed anything but abject despair over Kirk's killing. They are calling for vengeance and retribution, and the campaign Vance effectively co-signed has already caused innumerable people to be doxxed, threatened, and professionally punished or fired for their speech, including many who were simply critical of Kirk's often extreme views, and some who were accused of glorifying his death despite having never commented on the matter at all. So, their cult is being whipped into a violent frenzy by its leaders. They've been waiting for this moment, this match, to light the fire. Their campaign of vengeance has already reached into our own community, with two Pinellas County teachers now at risk for some unspecified consequences for comments made in their personal social media accounts. This comes as educators around the state and around the country are coming under scrutiny for similar comments. Next week, we will learn more as Midpoint will be focused on these attacks on public and private employees for their comments made in their personal social media accounts. What are the limits and boundaries of free speech? Does the First Amendment still exist? Tune in next Wednesday for a discussion about that. But now, we are going to be discussing a completely different topic. Florida's proposal to ban all mandatory vaccines, particularly for children in public school. Let me welcome my very patient guests. Dr. Thomas U. Nash is an Emeritus Distinguished University Professor, formerly of the Center for Global Health and Infectious Disease at the USF College of Public Health. He is a PhD researcher in infectious diseases, and he is the author of over 300 research papers in peer-reviewed literature. He has served as a member or chair of many World Health Organization advisory boards and committees, and he is here speaking in his personal capacity, having recently retired from USF. So welcome back to Midpoint, Dr. U. Nash. We last had you with us, I think, last year before your retirement to discuss bird flu. I'm happy to have you back.
Thank you, Shelley. Happy to be here.
And Dr. Neil Manimala is with us. Dr. Manimala is a board-certified urologist who received both his undergraduate and medical degrees from USF. He's here in his capacity as president-elect of the Hillsborough County Medical Association to give us some institutional perspective on Florida's proposal to ban mandatory vaccines. He's also a Democratic candidate for Hillsborough County Commission, District 5, a countywide seat. And I'm happy to have you back with us too, Dr. Manimala.
Thanks so much, Shelley. Appreciate you.
Let's start with this. What vaccines are mandatory for public school children? How are they made mandatory, and why are they mandatory? Let me start with you, Dr. U. Nash.
Sure. There are about seven or eight vaccines here in Florida that are currently mandatory for a child to attend school. The biggest ones are the DTaP, diphtheria, typhoid, and whooping cough or pertussis. Measles, mumps, and rubella, the MMR vaccine, and polio. Those are legislatively mandated vaccines, and they would require an act of the legislature to change the mandatory nature of those particular shots.
So the Florida Surgeon General coming out and saying we're getting rid of all vaccines is really nothing. I mean, unless there's some Florida legislative action.
Exactly.
He's just talking.
Exactly. He's sort of talking through his hat on those important central vaccines.
And there are others, aren't there, that are recommended, but
There are others that are actually also still required, but they're required through just the action of the Florida Department of Health. This is chickenpox, hepatitis B, which is a really serious infection of the liver. Haemophilus influenza, which can cause meningitis, bacterial meningitis. Up until the vaccine was developed, it was a really big problem among college-age students where they had a lot of contact together in dormitories and can be a really serious and irreversible infection. And finally, pneumococcal pneumonia are the other four that are recommended or now required by the Florida State Health Department.
So
he can eliminate those.
He can eliminate those.
Over a period of about, I think it's going to take like 40 to 60 days to do so.
Is there some like public notice requirement and, you know, where the public gets to be heard on a decision like that by the Florida Department of Health?
No, it's pretty much unilateral. He or they can go ahead and do this just with a unilateral dictate.
So those he can get rid of just by fiat.
By fiat, exactly.
Yeah. All right. Dr. Manimala, what's the position of the American Medical Association, the American Academy of Pediatrics, your own organization, the Hillsborough County Medical Association, and other professional groups on the Latipo proposal to ban mandatory vaccines? What do these professional organizations have to say?
I would say that on a national, state, and local level, you know, these professional organizations are virtually unanimous in their embrace of science and their explicit, you know, pushback against, you know, the state's decision to do this, to eliminate vaccine mandates. Certainly the American Medical Association, the American Academy of Pediatrics, and the American College of Physicians, internal medicine doctors have all come out with very strong position statements explicitly about Florida, the Florida Medical Association, and certainly my organization, the Hillsborough County Medical Association. And it speaks to, you know, certainly, you know, experts will say certain things, and you know, the science and data and researchers will say certain things, but I think that in so many ways we here on a local level, you know, the physicians, nurses, other healthcare providers who see these patients day in and day out, who become ill, and you know, oftentimes in many preventable ways, really need to be speaking up here. You know, this is not a time to be toeing the line. This is not a bit of time to be trying to be gaining political capital for an advocacy effort. You either take a stand or you don't. This is about protecting our children.
Well, the Florida legislature is going to be meeting in committee, you know, in the fall. And, you know, that would be the time to contact your local representatives and make your feelings known about this proposal.
And I'll tell you, Shelley, I've had countless, you know, pediatricians especially kind of reaching out to me, really concerned. Because, you know, when you think about it, you know, what some of the critics claim is that, you know, doctors, you know, pediatricians, et cetera, I mean, that we're somehow in the pocket of big pharma and that we want, from a business standpoint, to mandate vaccines. No, if you really were thinking from a business standpoint purely in profits over people, then no, you would want nobody to get vaccinated because then you'll keep seeing them in the office. That's not what people are here for, right? People want to protect patients. People want to protect their kids. And pediatricians have reached out about how we can advocate. And to be honest with you, in this time period now, before our state legislators especially, they're preparing to go up to Tallahassee for committee week in October. As they prepare, or the committee weeks begin in October, yeah, as they prepare for the session to start. And this is the time we got to really be reaching out. And it's very interesting because, you know, certainly we know where the super minority in the state legislature stands. They've made very public comments, and I appreciate folks like Leader Fentress Driscoll for being clear about, you know, positions on vaccine mandates. But it's very interesting because even amongst the Republican supermajority, there is dissent. There is a lot of disagreement regarding this because even DeSantis himself made it clear when he came out and made that press conference about 2 weeks ago, and the Surgeon General came out and said they were limiting vaccine mandates. There's a lot of politics here, right? You know, this is about, he was teasing at it, but I think there might be a little truth to it, that they're just kind of auditioning Ladapo to become CDC head, you know, and trying to make some points here. So
maybe
politics need to get out of healthcare here.
You know, maybe, but, you know, the big question is, will the Florida legislature go along with this proposal? Mm-hmm. And news reports following the big announcement have indicated that some Republicans would like to hear from their constituents, particularly parents of school-age children. You know, the translation of that is, if we're going to stand up to DeSantis, even in his last legislative session next year, we need some political cover. Sadly, as Politico reported, a Republican state House member who requested anonymity given the sensitivity surrounding this topic called the proposal a non-starter. I mean, how embarrassing is it that a Republican legislator demanded anonymity for a statement like that? I have to check with my constituents on whether they think mandatory vaccines are bad. I mean, really, it's kind of embarrassing that that they're afraid to just, you know, say their position on their own.
Yeah.
You know, Ladapo's position is that it's the mandatoriness, if that's a word, it's the mandatoriness of the vaccines that is a problem. He says, quote, if you want them, God bless, you can have as many as you want, close quote. And if you don't want them, parents should have the ability and the power to decide what goes into their children's bodies. It's that simple, close quote. That's Ladapo speaking. But don't parents already have that power? I mean, we have a number of exemptions in Florida for medical and religious reasons to avoid vaccination, but we don't have an exemption for philosophical reasons. We can't, you know, just say, hey, I don't believe in vaccines, or my politics don't permit me to vaccinate my children. But we do have medical and religious exemptions. I mean, this is not unique to vaccines either. There are lots of things that I don't want my tax dollars to pay for example, but there's no philosophical exemption from taxes paying for things you don't agree with. This is sort of similar. I mean, if you have a sincere religious belief that vaccination would, you know, violate your religious principles, if you're a Christian Scientist, for example, or I don't know, Jehovah's Witness maybe is another one that doesn't believe in vaccines, then you can make that pitch. And of course, there's medical exemptions too. What do we know about those exemptions?
Well, with the religious exemption, the state of Florida requires that the parent fill out a form saying my religion prevents me from having my children vaccinated and sign that form.
Yeah, there's no proof
follow-up.
Required.
There's no proof. There's no reason that you... So you're saying that it's not a philosophical... Well, I would argue that it's almost a philosophical thing because you can claim any religion that, you know, my own personal...
My Pastafarian
religion says that I shouldn't vaccinate my children.
Right.
There's apparently
no proof required for a religious exemption. You need to get the form. You need to present it to the school. There's under Florida law, officials cannot question the validity of a parent's religious objections or require additional administrative proof, such as documentation from a religious leader. And there's no expiration date on that religious exemption, right?
Correct. No expiration date.
Yeah. So, and we have medical exemptions too, right?
Correct.
Now, yep. There you do need... you do need a form co-signed by a medical provider, and that can also be temporary or permanent.
Depending on who you can shop around for a physician to sign it. But, I mean, the thing is here that the conversation and debate about parent choice, you know, as it related to this announcement 2 weeks ago about getting rid of mandates, is indeed disingenuous, right? You know, we know these exemptions have already existed, and Florida has actually been very high in terms of the rates of how many people have already kind of, used some of these exemptions. I think, you know, on average around the entire state, the rate of exemptions was hovering around 6.5%, some counties up to 15%. And, you know, it's one thing if it was an issue that was a strictly individualistic concern, right? But we do know that these concepts of herd immunity, you know, that's the term that's oftentimes applied where...
Yeah, explain that.
Yeah, I can take
over
on that.
Yeah, go for it, please.
Yeah, so the idea with herd immunity is that if you have a population that's highly immune to any infectious disease when it comes in, the infection when it comes in is going to have a really hard time defining susceptible people to infect. And if you reach a certain point with that, every infected person that comes in will infect less than one additional person. And if that happens, basically what happens, the whole population, the infectious disease can't get a foothold and it will die out.
Die out.
The number or the percentage of the population that has to be susceptible declines as the infectiousness of that infectious disease increases. And so the ones that we are vaccinated against, particularly things like measles and mumps and German measles or rubella, are highly infectious, which means that only a very small proportion of the population needs to be susceptible for those things to maintain themselves and grow and create an epidemic.
And spread
from one person to another person. So for measles, for example, that number... Measles being one of the most infectious, if not the most infectious virus ever known to man, the percentage of the population that needs to be immune needs to be 95% or better.
Yep.
Okay, and if you're looking at that
kind of... And immune means people who have been vaccinated or people who have previously had measles.
Exactly.
And built immunity that way.
And built immunity to it. And if you look at those numbers, then you start to consider about people who cannot be vaccinated. With bona fide medical reasons that your child cannot be vaccinated. Okay, you're putting those people, if you're in a population where there's less than that number, it's going to be able to be spread, and you're going to put those people at risk. So the population as a whole needs to have a high level of immunity to protect those people who either don't respond to the vaccine or have a good reason that they couldn't get the vaccine in the first place.
What are we at right now, numbers-wise?
In Florida, I believe it's at 88%
yes.
overall.
Yeah.
88% immunity?
Vaccinations.
Or vaccinated?
Yeah, among children. Oh, schools.
Among
with,
children.
And that's with vaccine requirements.
That's with the vaccine requirements.
And this question, I'm all for choice, but what about the choice of that immunocompromised toddler?
They have no choice.
What about the choice of the person, the kid who has a true medical reason for not being able to get that vaccine? And taking off my physician hat, I mean, my wife and I are expecting a child later this year, our first kid. What about my daughter's choice to mm-hmm. be able to be free of fear of death when for a random cough?
Yeah. You know, the question of making them mandatory, which is the issue that apparently chafes Latipo and DeSantis so much, do we not trust parents to want to protect their kids like the way that you've just expressed, hey, I'm worried about, you know, my child? Don't we trust parents to want to protect their kids?
No.
Okay. Explain that.
I think the answer to that is if you do have a disease or an infection that has been basically eliminated through a high level of immunity, people forget about it and they forget about how bad it is. And a lot of mothers and a lot of parents out there are going to rely on the fact that everybody else is getting their child vaccinated. So if I don't vaccinate my child, they will be protected anyway because everyone around them is going
yes.
to be
now that's a point that I hear from some parents, and also some teachers have said, I'm totally fearful of my classroom being in my classroom with a bunch of mm-hmm. unvaccinated kids. My question is, if a teacher, an adult, is vaccinated or has immunity because they, you know, had measles when they were a kid or something, but if the teacher has some immunity, should they be afraid of being in a room with a bunch of kids that are not immune?
The answer to that is yes.
Okay, why?
Because we're not talking necessarily here about mortality, but morbidity. A lot of people will get an immunity to a particular, like measles, that will prevent them from getting really, really seriously ill and dying from that infection.
So the vaccination doesn't necessarily prevent you from getting the disease. It prevents you from winding up with a really bad case leading to death of that disease. Is that it? It's
exactly.
like prophylactic, but not preventative.
Exactly. And we've seen that cases of this among pediatricians in West Texas in this latest outbreak in measles, where pediatricians have come down with measles. And they've run a fever of 104 degrees and been sick as a dog for a week.
This is one of those things where you don't have to be a historian. You just literally have to look at the national news and the current events to know that situations with vaccines work, situations in which a lack of vaccines clearly leads to more disease. And, you know, on the teacher front, right, beyond individual health, we know that classrooms are going to get shut down. You know, how are we going to be good stewards of taxpayer dollars and ensuring that classrooms run efficiently and that kids are getting taught and are able to, again, have their freedom to learn, right? If classrooms are getting shut down with illness after illness, it is clearly preventable. Now, to the earlier question about whether or not we trust parents, right? I mean, I would actually say I ultimately do trust the instinct of all parents to want to make sure their kids are safe. I think that in some ways, you know, medical establishments, professionals, and sometimes, researchers, we've created a vacuum where, indeed, politicians with not the best intentions, snake oil salesmen and saleswomen, right, charlatans have come in and allowed an appeal to emotion that ultimately, fills in a gap with wrong answers by all means. But they'll go to any extent here in Florida, unfortunately, including putting our children's lives at stake to be able to win some political points. I think here, you know, obviously we can talk about the data, the research, the guidelines and all that. And that's where I do in some way, shape or form, put on that physician leader hat. But when I take that hat off and I say, and I make that appeal from the standpoint of being a parent. I mean, I want my kid to be safe, right? Being a neighbor, I want to make sure all kids in my neighborhood are safe. Even being a Catholic, you know, there are some folks within my own religious tradition who, you know, have made some claims about religious exemption. But I believe as a Catholic in the dignity of every soul, in the sanctity of every single child, and their ability and opportunity to be able to go to school, to be able to get that education, to be able to not worry about whether or not they're going to get ill.
Well, let me Let me pivot off what you just said. First of all, these requirements of mandatory vaccines only apply to public school students, right? They do not apply to private school students or homeschooled kids, right? So, you know, you talk about being a Catholic. I mean, you could send your kid to a Catholic school and you have the choice not to vaccinate your kid, right?
Yep. Yep.
I mean, or all of these charter schools. I don't know whether they're quasi-public schools. I don't know whether they are governed by the same requirement for mandatory vaccines.
The issue and problem is a question of access, right? And even within, you know, privileged communities, you hear from parents all the time where daycares that allow vaccine exemptions versus daycares that do not allow vaccine exemptions, right? You know, that latter has a wait list that go years upon years. Your kid is, you know, starting elementary school before they even get off the wait list. But then we also talk about access in communities that are underprivileged. And we have a lot of those here in Hillsborough County, where truly, if vaccine requirements are no longer there, eventually we're going to have questions as to whether or not, these are questions of whether or not there's even going to be coverage for vaccines. Mm. And when a family is having to make a decision between vaccinating their kid feeding them and keeping a roof over their head, you know, I completely understand why folks would choose the latter, especially when there's so much disinformation that is floating around in our communities.
Well, right now we have these programs that make vaccines available even to people who can't afford them. Yeah. But if I understand you correctly, that may change if the number of people who are getting vaccinated, you know, declines so much, right?
Yep.
Is that what you mean?
Yep.
The other issue about you know, people who are poor or uneducated, those parents don't necessarily regularly take their kids to a doctor. Maybe they can't afford it in our medicine-for-profit environment. Or maybe they don't know of these resources that are available for free or reduced cost healthcare. But they don't go. They don't go. They don't take their kids to the doctor. So mandatory vaccines are sometimes the only thing that gets them to take their kids to the doctor. And when they do, that's maybe the opportunity for the doctor to observe perhaps other health conditions that might be discovered in those vaccine appointments, right? So, you know, it's not just that kids are necessarily at risk for the diseases that the vaccines prevent, but, you know, maybe there's things that are going undiscovered because these kids are not going to a doctor, whether it's, you know, physical abuse at home or, you know, a kid with some other kind of medical condition.
You're 100% correct, Shelley, and that's a very good point. I mean, honestly, you know, sometimes, you know, going with certain groups, even church groups where we do medical mission trips to other countries, that's sometimes the point of contact and exposure to some of the kids where you give them vaccines, but then you also diagnose other issues.
Yeah, you do a physical on them, right?
Right. And, you know, it's just so unfortunate we're having to have the same conversation here in America. Yeah. Right. And I feel in so many ways this is where we are taking a lot of steps backwards, because, you know, really when it comes to our medical care, when it comes to the basics, you know, this should be a nonpartisan issue. Right.
Absolutely. You know, Dr. Unash, you go all over the world, or you have gone all over the world dealing with infectious diseases in different populations around the world. I mean, are you surprised to see this issue coming up in a population in a rich country like the United States? How do you understand what is happening psychologically that is causing so many parents to not want to vaccinate their kids?
I think the answer to that is there's a lot of misinformation out there, and it's human nature. Okay. I used to be a Boy Scout leader, and I used to tell the scouts that there were sort of three groups of people in this world. The smart people learn from other people's experiences. Most everybody, on average, will only learn from their own experiences. And the stupid people don't even learn from their own experiences and make their mistakes over and over and over again. In this country, we really haven't seen large outbreaks of these childhood infectious diseases for years. And as a result, people don't have any personal experience with having a nephew or a niece die of measles or die of whooping cough or being paralyzed with polio. In other countries, on the other hand, where I go into Africa, this is not the case. And I can tell you that the people I talk to are lining up to get their child vaccinated because they know somebody who has a child who's died of measles or died of whooping cough. Mm-hmm. And so it's a part of their daily personal experience. When you don't have that, it's a lot harder for these parents to look at this and say, well, I haven't really seen this experience of this sort of a disease, and why should I really worry about it? It doesn't really exist anymore. Mm-hmm. And they're correct about that because of the mandatory vaccines. We've basically gotten all of these under control, and these are no longer problems.
Right. Apparently, like up to 2000, in 2000, these diseases were pretty much declared finished in the United States,
in
right?
In measles in particular. Unfortunately, that's no longer the case. We now have outbreaks of measles that are recurring primarily among populations, interestingly enough, where the vaccination levels are quite low.
Yeah.
So we had an outbreak about 3 years ago in New York City among a highly Orthodox Jewish community where vaccination rates were very low due to religious reasons. West Texas may still be ongoing with the measles outbreak that's been there, several hundred cases among communities that just don't get vaccinated.
And I think one of the things that people don't understand is how serious a measles infection can be, a measles disease can be. I mean, it's not always, you know, like it's not always putting a child at death's door, but it can. And I think people don't realize that. I mean, I remember years ago, I mean, when I was, you know, young, before the measles vaccine even existed, you know, you had to get measles in order to get your immunity. There was no vaccine. And then a few years later, people started having measles parties to try to put their kids together and expose them to measles to build their immunity. People don't realize, though, that, you know, it can be not so serious, but it can also be very serious. Who wants to talk about that? I think people need to know that.
Yeah, you could end up with encephalitis and pneumonia, and children die of measles fairly frequently. I think the death rate of amongst measles in an unimmunized population is about 2 to 3 per 1,000 of the infections. So children do die from that. I'd like to expand upon that a little bit as well. When people talk about these childhood vaccines, they say, well, natural immunity will take care of this. You hear this a lot among the people who say, I don't want to put anything foreign in my body. My child will get these immunities naturally.
Yeah, you hear that a lot.
And that's absolutely true. Okay, you look at 1890, okay, before the development of the childhood vaccines. Life expectancy at birth was 42 years. Hmm. If you lived to the age of 20, it was 64 years. And you know why that was?
Hmm.
The reason was that 22% of the children died of these infectious diseases before the age of 5. So if you made it to 5 and you got these infections and you got the natural immunity, you were fine.
Hmm.
But what about those 1 in 4 kids who died? Do we want to go back to that? The rate of serious side effects right now to the Tdap vaccine are 1 in 1,000,000. Okay, are we going to go back to a situation where we're going to rely on natural immunity and 1 in 4 children are going to die? Right now, the death rate under the age of 5 is 0.6%. It's like a 40-fold improvement resulting only from childhood vaccinations.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, there are other issues that I hear from people who are critical of mandatory vaccines, like we don't know what's in them. Mm-hmm. And, you know, they cause autism. And, you know, there's all kinds of different additives in these vaccines that we don't know what they are and we're wary of them. What do you have to say about that?
This was all an outspring of a paper that was published in Lancet about 20 years ago by a man named Andrew Wakefield, who associated the mercury preservative in the vaccines, the Marisol, with the development of autism. Turned out that Andrew Wakefield had faked all of those results. He had just made the numbers up. He was being paid for by an anti-vax group to do so. The paper was retracted by The Lancet, and he ended up going to jail.
Ah.
And so that whole question of the mercury preservatives, there haven't been any mercury preservatives in any of our vaccines for over a decade now.
Well, that's kind of interesting. Why did they take them out if there was no basis to believe that they were dangerous?
They went in and they found other preservatives that were less toxic and that worked just as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, because mercury is toxic. I mean, we hear about don't eat too much tuna because it's got mercury in it and can cause problems.
Yeah.
Okay, but the fact is there's no more mercury in vaccines.
It hasn't been for 10 years.
Mm-hmm. For 10 years, okay. All right, well, you know.
And the numbers were bogus in the first place, and the guy who wrote that up went to jail for that purpose,
right.
Because for publishing that, because it was so destructive.
Yeah. Right. You know, it's interesting. There's a whole community of primarily moms, you know, that have taken the position that I just don't want to put anything foreign in my kid, in my kid's body. You know, this is like the crunchy mom community, apparently it's called. You know, how can we speak to that kind of attitude about, you know...
I think in my medical practice all the time, and I talk to patients often who are like, I don't want to take meds, I don't want to take this, and that's been an increasing trend in having that conversation. I completely understand it. Even talking to my parents who are now retired and are on, you know, getting told they got to take all these meds, you know, obviously the ideal is to kind of treat it quote unquote naturally. Obviously, the ideal is to do diet and exercise when it comes to, you know, cardiovascular illness, right, as opposed to taking that statin. You know, and the corollary here as it relates to vaccines is we got to be sure we appeal to that common ground. We all want to make sure that child, that, you know, that mom's kid is safe. But, you know, we have to make sure that there's an understanding as to what these vaccines actually do. I mean, right now, like I've said, we've unfortunately, there's been a little bit of a vacuum, a little bit of an echo, a blank space has been filled indeed by the charlatans, by the Wakefields of the world. Right. And it's up to us as professionals to be able to say, yeah, you know, we can be professorial in some cases and share the data, literature and guidelines. But in some way, shape or form, we ought to be able to bring it in human terms. Right. And help them understand that, you know, let's take the politician out of that room between the physician and the patient, the nurse and the patient. Let's make sure that we can be that advocate for that.
Well, kid. Vaccines are not the only issue.
Yes.
Where politics has invaded the relationship between medical professionals and their patients. I mean, let's be real. I mean, you know, look at the abortion debate,
yes.
For example. You know, politics has invaded all different facets of medicine, particularly in Florida. We don't have expanded Medicaid, for example. We're not making it so that everybody has the opportunity to get health care. You know, now with this big, ugly bill that has come out of the Trump Congress, you know, healthcare has been restricted even more. The Obama subsidies are going away and all these people just won't get healthcare.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, I personally just don't understand that. I just don't understand how we can be a society that allows people to go without health care.
These are ultimately, you know, these are fundamental questions of dignity, right? And preserving the dignity of every soul, both within this county and the state and certainly the United States as a whole, but it's also a testament to the fact that elections do have consequences. It's important, however, that we don't keep our hands up and just wait 2 years or 4 years or whatever it is for the next race. We put as much pressure as can be placed at these critical moments, these inflection points, like right now, for instance, as it relates to these vaccine mandates potentially disappearing, we can't put our hands up and say, hey, state legislators, let it go and give in to DeSantis's whim. No, they can push back. They're ready and willing to listen in many cases. I'm a urologist, and we talk about it in our field. It's called testicular fortitude. You know, right? You got to have a little bit of that, regardless of, you know, what gender you are. You know, as a state legislator, let's give them a reason as a state legislator to kind of push back. This is one that should be a nonpartisan issue.
It should be, but it isn't. And I think the only way that there's going to be the kind of pressure that moves people in politics is if enough people, enough people gather together and decide that they need to persuade their representatives in a certain direction, and that means that you've got to be able to persuade people on a one-on-one basis. You know, you've got to talk to some of these moms and explain to them. And I wonder, Dr. Unesh, you're not a medical provider per se, but and the places that you go to do your research, as you said, people are very happy. They're thrilled to get their kids vaccinated. It's totally different from what we're seeing now. And I wonder, you know, how do we approach these moms who say, I don't want to put anything foreign in my kid's body. I don't want to put my kid at risk. Because the fact is, you know, there are some fatalities associated with some vaccines, right? It's not never that there are problems with vaccines that cause you know, kids to be sick or even die, right? It's not never, right?
Absolutely. And I think it goes back to the whole question of personal experience and what people are going to experience. I think this is going to be a self-correcting phenomenon. What we saw in West Texas, for example, okay, was this outbreak occurred among a population that had relatively low levels of vaccination. And when the children started getting sick with measles, you know what happened with all those mothers who weren't getting their kids vaccinated?
They all got vaccinated?
Well, no. What they did is they ran to their physician and they said, oh my God, there's measles in my kid's school. Please vaccinate my child. And the response of the physicians in many cases were, I'm sorry, ma'am. We're all out of the vaccine. You're too late. Because there have been 20 other moms who stepped in here already and have gotten their kids vaccinated ahead of you.
Wow.
And that is what I think is going to happen.
Are we seeing shortages of vaccines?
Well, they were local shortages.
I know that with the COVID vaccine, for example, you know, the availability of the new COVID, the 2025-26 COVID vaccine, the Moderna vaccine, the availability of it has been made, has been restricted. You know, now you can get it without a prescription if you're over age 65. Otherwise, you need a prescription from your medical provider. And I don't even know if kids can get it, you know.
Kids can get it if they have a medical reason to need the shot, whether it's severe asthma.
So they would need a prescription too?
Yes.
Yeah.
But that's not really a shortage. What that is a politically driven public health decision to restrict availability.
Uh-huh.
If LaDapo got up tomorrow and said, I've changed my mind. God spoke to me last night and said that mRNA vaccines were actually the greatest thing that has come along the line. And I now agree with the Nobel Committee from 2 years ago who awarded the Nobel Prize in Medicine for this and said, so we're going to release this. The supply would be there.
Okay. Well, you know, one of the things about these mRNA vaccines is, as I understand it from my reading, they were on the cusp of developing an mRNA vaccine for cancer when a lot of the funding for that research has been canceled by the Trump administration. I mean, imagine a vaccine for cancer.
Now, there's been a lot of progress that's been made in vaccinations, and mRNA vaccines are probably going to end up being, a lot of people are saying, the equivalent of penicillin for cancers when these things are developed. And so having a backward point of view towards doing the research and killing the research, I think, is just sort of indicative of sort of the position where we're in with Make America Great Again. Our president believes that America was greatest under McKinley in the 1890s.
Well, what is the argument? What is the argument against the mRNA vaccine? Can we articulate that? I mean, what are people so afraid of with regard to that?
I think it basically...
You're changing your cellular structure or something?
You know, there's a lot of sort of canards that have been put out on that direction. I think if you look at the data... There is no argument against the mRNA.
And this is what it comes down to, right? It's not about the data or the actual evidence, right? It's about the fact that it's a spooky mRNA, like 5G, right? You know, it's the other. It's that thing that they're injecting in me for mind control, changing my DNA. But, you know, yes, it is important to kind of talk about the basic biology. You got the DNA, the blueprint, right?
Yeah. Most parents are not as schooled in the statistics and the research as you who are a medical doctor, right. You who are an infectious disease researcher. I mean, you have this information at your fingertips. Most parents don't have it. You know, they're pretty much like at the mercy of what they get in the news, or maybe even what they get in the school car line from other people who are equally as uninformed.
Who are reading it on the internet.
Yeah. Well,
and you know, it couldn't be on the internet if it wasn't true, right?
Yeah. I know you're being facetious.
And this is sort of the levels and the sort of thing that it's coming from. But there really is no evidence that the mRNA vaccine, first of all, it won't change your DNA. Mm-hmm. It cannot do that. And the real concern, I think, is exactly what you said. It's just the fear of the unknown. You know, I looked a little bit at the history, and there were movements in the 1930s to encourage people not to get antibiotics because antibiotics were new. Mm. And we don't want to put anything in our body that's foreign. And there was an argument back then, which we may even hear again now. You're interfering with God's will.
Mm. Oh, okay.
If you try and cure a bacterial infection with penicillin.
Yeah. And that's that. This idea of it has to be the survival of the fittest is not in keeping with what we consider the social contract for living in this society, right? You know, there are some individual freedoms that sometimes you put at the door in order to ensure that we have a greater society. I mean, I remember the TV interviews they had with folks in certain parts of the country when, you know, there were all these bans on drunk driving. A lot of people were like, that's infringing on my liberties and whatnot. And technically, in some ways, that's true. Mm-hmm. But for the greater good of society as a whole, you know, drunk driving doesn't affect just the individual in the car.
Right.
It affects all the people on the road as well.
Right, but there are comparisons to things like seatbelt laws and motorcycle helmet laws. But really, that's a totally different thing because the dangers from not wearing seatbelts or a motorcycle helmet are pretty much just to the person who made the decision to not use that protection. Whereas if I understand it, the dangers of not getting vaccinated are much more far-reaching to mm-hmm. others.
It's like driving the wrong way down I-275.
Yeah, right? So I I just think that we have to come up with a better way to talk to people about vaccines. We have to come up with a way to meet people where they're at and make them understand, you know, that they're safe. They're safe, and they're going to make your kids safer. And, you know,
I think the problem that is exemplified perhaps by the philosophy of Dr. Ladapo and a lot of the people that are out there is that these things need to be perfectly safe. I think Dr. Ladapo strongly believes in his Hippocratic Oath that said, do no harm. But if you're a physician, the reason that you're a physician is to do good, is to heal.
Mm.
And his position is, well, I'm not going to do anything because if I do something, I might harm someone.
Yeah.
So I'm not going to give an injection. I'm not going to give any medicine. I'm not going to give any advice. Because if I do, I might harm someone.
The problem is not doing something here is harmful.
Exactly.
Right? Fundamentally.
And in fact, everything that we do has a risk.
Yeah, you have to sign all these consent forms when you go to the hospital for some procedure or...
All right. You got up this morning. You got out of bed. Okay. When that alarm went off, you made a decision.
Yeah.
Okay.
Even though I felt terrible because I got my COVID vaccine yesterday and I did have a reaction.
Right, but your choice was, I'm going to lay here in bed and I'm going to take the chance of developing a blood clot in my leg that's going to flip to my brain and kill me. Or I'm going to get up and I'm going to step into the bathroom and I'm going to slip and I'm going to fall and I'm going to hit my head on the bathtub and it's going to kill me. You balanced those risks when you got up this morning. Everything we do is a balance of risks.
Yeah, and I think people need to avail themselves of the actual research and not be persuaded by stuff they read on the internet that is, in some way colored by some political perspective.
For a childhood vaccine, one in a million now. For an alternative, versus 20% deaths without getting it.
Okay.
It's an easy balance.
That's
easy
all we have time for today, my friends. So tune in next week for a show addressing the potential problems for employees of speaking out on social media. Until then, thanks very much to my guest today, Dr. Thomas Unash, our infectious disease specialist, and Dr. Neil Manamala, president-elect of the Hillsborough County Medical Association. We really appreciate your time today. Thanks also to our WMNF operations volunteers, Jessica Green and Barbara Fling. Duncan is up next with Talking Animals following the NPR News. And we are WMNF Tampa, and we're out of here. Time is really wasted.